Welcome back to Too Much Future, the show where we play through the Fallout games and talk about them. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
Michael, last episode we finished up the Fallout 2, mm-hmm. the video game.
Yes.
Fallout 2, comma, the video game. as distinct from the TV show.
Fallout 2, the original video game experience, now a major motion picture.
Oh, yeah. In case people don't know that. Now, several weeks ago, by the time you're hearing this, but recently it was announced that Fallout's getting a TV show. So maybe by the time we get through Fallout, the online one, 76. 76?
Yes.
Is that? 76. It should have been called the online
one. I was going to say, I really like the idea of them just calling it Fallout, the online one.
The online one. By the time we get through that or get, you know, whatever, when we talk about that. I'm sure it'll still be in development hell. I'm sure it won't be out yet. But if it is, we'll talk about it. This episode, we're doing something a little bit different. We are talking about a thing called the Fallout Bible. The Fallout Bible is a collection of developer information, answers to questions from fans, design document stuff that was posted online by Fallout 2 designer Chris Avalone in the early 2000s, kind of in the lead up to Van Buren, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about a little bit in this episode, which would have been kind of Fallout 3.
Yes.
Now, something to say here at the beginning, as we're kind of talking about it, over the past couple weeks, there have been really severe allegations coming out about Chris Avalone. Especially about the way that he treats women in the games industry and kind of wielding influence and power over them. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to Kotaku. You know, just give a Google. Here's the name of the article. Multiple women accuse games writer Chris Avalone of sexual misconduct. The reason we're talking about this is not to talk about Chris Avalone specifically, but because the Fallout Bible, as we talk about it, I think this will become really clear. The Fallout Bible actually has a big impact on Fallout 3 and like kind of Fallout going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Weirdly enough, so it's a set of documents that are put online after Fallout 2 is finished. But there's all kinds of ideas and kind of lore clarifications and things like that that really show up, I think, in the later games. And so we're talking about it kind of as this peripheral document, this kind of paratext, but that ultimately has wielded a whole lot of influence on it. Unfortunately, put together by Chris Avalone, and so we kind of got to talk about that and kind of have to talk about the authorial voice a little bit there. But really, this is a document that is just mostly collated from all kinds of other things, and that's the reason we're talking about it.
Yeah. If you have never heard of or looked at or read the Fallout Bible, one way of thinking about this is that it's kind of like it's an anticipation of the Reddit Ask Me Anything kind of thread. Mm-hmm. But that's just sort of being run by Avalone himself on a blog where people are writing in questions and he is answering them and providing documentation from, you know, developer materials, notes, things that weren't actually included in the final game and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and they kind of come out in like newsletter format. And so they are big amalgamated documents. I think there were 10 updates, if that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find them if you just Google Fallout Bible. There's a couple of really easy ways of getting a hold of it. One is what appears to be like a fan compiled version that's on a few Fallout 1 and 2 fan websites that still exist. Probably the way that most people would easily access it today is that GOG.com put together their own PDF of it when they released Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 on GOG. And so if you already own either of those games, you have the Fallout Bible in your like extras in your GOG library. So you can go download it right now. It's like a, you know, 70 megabyte PDF and you can scroll through the whole thing. And it's an interesting and weird document that it very much feels like it is from the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. It very much feels of a piece with Fallout. And you know, we've read it over the past couple of weeks. So Michael, you got any big ideas, big thoughts about the Fallout Bible?
Sort of big thoughts is, at the end of the last episode, at the end of Fallout 2, I said that this is when Fallout actually becomes Fallout, because there's a big plot twist slash retcon that gets introduced at the end of Fallout 2 about the Enclave and the vaults and sort of this whole thing. And what I talked about there is one of the reasons I feel like Fallout becomes Fallout at that moment is because it gives the player this excuse, or not really even excuse, but that's one way you may want to think of it, but in some ways kind of the charge to go back through and play these games and try to refit all of the stuff that you have seen up until this point into this grand kind of meta narrative about the pre-war world of the setting and the Enclave and the vaults being social experiments and things like that. I would say the Fallout Bible is a literalization of this, right? This is what happens when you have a whole bunch of players who have gone through and played these games and tried to link up all of the dots in their heads, and they're not making all of the connections that they want to make because it was a retcon. This was not a reveal that was planned from the beginning, and so the setting as a fiction is incoherent in certain ways. And this entire document is this weird, like, author-reader interaction where everyone is trying to make this into a more coherent setting, trying to make everything sort of fit together in a way that the world becomes, like, logically cohesive in a way that is, well, the explicit purpose, because throughout this entire document, Avalon insists that Fallout 3 is not being developed, it's not happening, he's not going to answer questions about it, so on and so forth. The ostensible purpose for him undertaking this exercise is he wants to get the setting clarified so he and some other people at Black Isle, I guess, can run a tabletop Fallout game.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But in the intro note for the GOG edition that is also written by him, he says explicitly that he was partially doing this because they were getting ready to do Fallout 3, which was called Van Buren at the time, when mm-hmm. Interplay were going to do it. So we're in Black Isle, we're going to do it. So there's a little bit of, like, bait and switch going on here. So it is this kind of document of coherence, and something that we haven't really talked about across the board. And, you know, it's just due to the way that we're interacting with these games that's different from the way that you would have in the 1990s. But which was pointed out, you know, Darius Kazemi and I on Twitter had a conversation about this, that the tone of Fallout and the way and the iconography of Fallout, which, you know, we have talked about repeatedly in the show, doesn't really show up that much in the game, is really apparent in the game manual,
mm-hmm.
right? The game manual has all this, like, the Pip-Boy doing, or Vault-Boy, sorry, doing all this different stuff. There's, like, all this additional graphic design going on. There's a tone about it mm-hmm. in the way that it's written. This is kind of, like, wry tone. And I think that, so that's one kind of missing piece that we haven't really talked about. And frankly, we're just not going to. But another missing piece, I think, that we just really can't speak to is the forum culture.
Mm-hmm.
That Fallout had a large forum culture around it of people talking and debating and trying to do exactly what you just said, Michael, trying to figure out how all of this incoherent stuff that we've talked about in the actual games, how it fits together into some sort of coherent world and story. And so there's, you know, it's almost like, you know, religious debates going on around canonicity, mm-hmm. right? Like, how does all of this fit together? And so what we're seeing in this kind of discussion that happens via questions, this kind of Reddit AMA kind of thing that shows up in the Fallout Bible, what we're seeing is almost like emissaries from the forums mm-hmm. coming and being like, excuse me, developers, could you confirm our theory about, you know, XYZ? And if that is true, then what does it mean for ABC? And there's actually quite a lot of that in this document of people saying things like, I think I wrote the quotation down. Oh, it's on page 154 of the document. But someone says, oh, I gotta get there. Blah, 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 blah. If you're reading the Fallout Bible, it's on page 154. This is from Peter Hopkins. I was reading version 5 of the Bible, and I found a bit of a conflict with current knowledge. In one of your answers, it was said that it was random whether the FEV increased intelligence or not. However, as far as I know, FEV increases the growth and integrity of all cells consistently by doubling the amount of genetic material in the cells. In this case, an increase in brain size, assuming a healthy brain to begin with, and intelligence should be regular. Another theory could be that, as the mutant's brain grows, the mass of the mutant's body increases exponentially, and the brain would not be big enough to control the whole body and sustain the thought process of a human body. And this just keeps going on and on, mm-hmm. right? So it's people with real, like, obviously this theory is not born just from someone's interaction with the game. This is something they have thought about and discussed with other people, and then created two potentially competing theories in order to determine what is happening with FEV.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, like, says, it demonstrates that so much of the work of thinking about Fallout and making Fallout coherent is happening in places that we just, like, have no access to at this point mm-hmm. in the year 2020. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, it is. One of the things I realized as I was reading this, I think way back in our first episode for the first game, I said that I heard about Fallout and tried to play the original Fallout and then played Fallout 2 basically at the behest of people who were on forums that I was hanging out on when I was, you know, in middle school and high school. And I realized as I was reading this, the guys on those forums who were urging me to play Fallout were 100% the guys writing in these questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like people who are building on the knowledge of the games and, like, the interesting pieces that they find are, frankly, their own theorizations of those pieces, right? Like, so little of this is in the actual game proper.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, here's a big question for you, Michael.
Okay.
Do you think that this is the source of Fallout is satire / Fallout is very interesting? The older games are better, that mm-hmm. kind of thing?
So, I have a couple of potential responses here, because, like, one thing I will point out is that no one in these documents is concerned with satire, really.
No.
Not at all. That is not a question. No one talks about it. No one gives a damn how satirical Fallout is. It is not a topic that comes up.
Another topic that doesn't come up, just to do that, is there's something, we've seen this again over the past couple days with the announcement of the Fallout TV show, but there is no talk here of this being critical of nuclear war.
Nope.
Or like, oh, the hubris of man. None of that is here in these groups of people mm-hmm. talking about the game.
So I would answer your first question, is this where we get the idea that Fallout is satire, with the second question, which is like, well, what do you mean by that? Because no one here is talking about satire. But is this where we get the idea that Fallout is interesting? I think so. Mm-hmm. Because what you see happening here is this kind of, I mean, you already compared it to, like, religious debates and canonicity of dogma and things like that. You see people who have, for whatever reason, decided to care very strongly about these games, getting to ask the creator, or one of the creators of these games, right? Someone who is, like, an authority with a capital A. That person hears their questions and responds to them and resolves disputes, right? It becomes this very almost, the word that gets thrown around on social media a lot today is the parasocial, right? But it's this mm-hmm. sense of being able to step up to this person and be like, excuse me, sir, I was wondering, you said earlier that the FEV did this one thing, but I was thinking about it and I noticed that the FEV might be doing this other thing, and could you please elaborate or explain? Like, that's actually pretty cool, right? Like, this is one of those things that, like, made the internet seem really awesome back in, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s, that there was this feeling of being put into contact with people in a closer way that with figures who would have been more remote. And suddenly mm-hmm. Fallout becomes kind of this work. I mean, as I've already said, right, it emphasizes the fact that, like, what Fallout is the work of piecing through this setting and trying to read it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird here that there's no or very little discussion of, like, builds or, like, mechanical questions. I mean, there's some of that content in here, but those are not the types of questions that people are asking about the game.
No.
You know, they're occasionally it's about like hidden items or things like that, but it's almost entirely based around timeline, backstory, people digging through the game files and finding things and then asking about their origin point or like the decisions behind it. I mean, all the questions are really about like the storytelling that the game is doing and yet is not fulfilling for people in some ways.
Yeah, there is literally a person in here who writes into Avalon, and the substance of their question is, and I am not exaggerating, going through and pointing out every corpse that you can find on the map in a wasteland, like a human corpse or a skeleton, that's sort of like what we think of now is like the Maison Sin corpse, right? The Bethesda mm-hmm. corpse of the skull next to the toilet. There aren't as many of those in these original two games. And so this person goes through and points out each one of these corpses in Fallout 2 and asks Chris Avalon, who is this person and how did they end up there? Like, how did they die? Who were they? And Chris Avalon, like, answers, right? He doesn't give them, like, little biographies and stuff, but, like, he gives, like, a hypothetical situation of how, like, someone might have come from a nearby settlement and died in such and such a way. And there's this really bizarre thing where everyone approaches the setting as if it were a real world, right? Where these things are going to have answers. Like, there's just that assumption. There is never, and I said this when I was talking with you, that I think it's really remarkable that, like, Avalon never resorts to what is one of my most frequent responses when people ask me questions about my creative work, which is, like, I made it up. Like, there's nothing there, right? Like, I needed a detail to communicate something, and so I made up that detail. There's not a backstory. There's not a world here that extends beyond the text. but everyone here is acting as if like there is a parallel universe where everything physically exists and there are mechanical laws of physics and biology and like there's history and so on and so forth. And that we're kind of like beaming in imaginatively and like picking up and reporting on details that we find.
It very much there is a what I might call like evocative or gestural, like Star Wars logic to Fallout 1 and 2 that I think due to the like ostensibly, right, the reason for doing this is to create a Fallout tabletop RPG. And in fact, they are playing that. And this is, I think, somewhere way back in the episodes where I said that I thought that they were developing Fallout 2 with a tabletop game. I was just getting that confused with the Van Buren stuff, which Avalon says in the intro note for the Fallout Bible, that's what they were using this tabletop game to do, was mm-hmm. kind of build some of those areas. So I had some brain on the fritz there. There is a way that Avalon approaches, obviously, the tabletop role-playing space, because you can see stat blocks that he builds for these for like Brahmin later, and they're just multiple pages of like GURPS style like charts. And so like it is a clockwork universe, I think, in the way that he positions it. And so what's really interesting to me here is that there's a kind of gestural or conceptual logic of like who cares in certain parts of Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 in the actual text. And when he's asking questions, because quite a few times he answers questions in this document by going and asking someone on the dev team and then kind of reporting back. And a lot of those times those answers are like, I don't know, or it was just a developer joke, or, you know, mm-hmm. or it doesn't matter, right? We didn't really think about it. At every turn where he is filling in that information, it's a clockwork universe. And at every turn where someone else who was working on the project is talking about it, it's really like, well, we just kind of landed on that. Mm-hmm. It's arbitrary. I made it up. So in some ways, I don't think I realized the extent of how much after Fallout 2, I think, kind of swims in the water that is Avalon putting this document together and then clockworkifying everything.
Mm-hmm.
Not just entertaining fan theories, but clarifying fan theories with objective information. And the timeline's a huge part of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he sets up a objectively correct Fallout timeline that has all of the major events and all of the referenced events from Fallout 1 and 2 in it. And as far as I know, that's still, like, true. You know, I don't think there's anything that's happened in Bethesda Fallout games to contradict in significant ways the basic building blocks of that timeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the other thing that I think is worth noting here is that there is pushback against this. Like, we don't get a lot of it because everything we're getting is being filtered through Avalon. But there are people... So when we're talking about the timeline, it appears that there was a debate among fans up until Avalon comes around and clarifies this. There is a debate about whether or not Fallout is like an alternate history, like that takes all, like something happened in the 50s and it takes place in sort of like a diverging timeline from that, or if it's something that is still like plausibly in the future of our world. Like, this seems to be something that people are debating, right? What is the relationship of the Fallout continuity to history as we know it? And Avalon steps in and says, like, it is an alternate history, like the timeline diverges after World War II. But he won't say what makes it diverge or like how it diverges. That's just sort of like the thing that he sets up. And then we get into these other debates that you start seeing people pushing back on him, clockworkifying the world. Because the thing that he uses a lot to clockworkify things is FEV. Mm-hmm. In terms of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So one of the reasons that the debate of when Fallout takes place, or like what type of world Fallout takes place in, has to do with the fact that it relies so much on 50s pulp aesthetics and sort of like atomic menace aesthetics, like the idea that being exposed to radiation is just going to make an animal extremely large rather than, you know, kill it. the fact that is a thing that appears to happen in Fallout, right? That the nuclear wasteland of Fallout appears to follow like 1950s B-movie logic in that being exposed to radiation just makes you like huge. And then what Avalon does is he sort of slips in and he's like, actually, the reason the roaches and the scorpions and the mantises are getting so big, the geckos are getting so big, is not really just because they were exposed to radiation. It's because FEV was released into the atmosphere, and the FEV, which of course has all of these really weird effects on humans, has these other types of effects on critters. And so suddenly... The 1950s look is still there, but the logic that underpins it becomes, again, more clockwork, a little, it's not hard science fiction, but it's a little harder, right? We have this third term that is not just radiation exposure that makes these mutations happen. And then there are fans who are angry about this, who write into Avalon and are like, no, that's not really like what Fallout was about, right? Fallout should be this, the comparison that gets made is to the Torg setting. Which is like superheroes and sort of like, you know, weird and cartoony physics. It is not like Torg as a setting is, and I don't have much familiarity with it. Do you, Cameron?
No.
Okay. So,
I mean, I know that it exists, right, but not beyond that.
Having like looked into it, right, my sense is that Torg is not interested in simulating a world in the way that, say, like, I don't know, Dungeons and Dragons is going to be very interested in simulating how much your character can carry as they're walking, or that sort of thing. And so Avalon apparently steps on the toes of some of the fans who want this world to be wackier and weirder, to have like less realistic alignments with the world. And do you remember the guy who like writes in really upset that real world locations appear in Fallout 2?
Yes. Says explicitly, but because it was actually on page 54, I wrote it down, because his logic at the end is that he's super mad about naming real locations in Fallout 2 as opposed to in Fallout 1, right, where, you know, the Boneyard, right, is LA. But you don't know that until you like get there and you kind of wander around. It's because, quote, post-nuke people would have named them differently anyway. Which is wild, because, but this is like where the timeline really smashes into things, right? Is because with the timeline, we realize there are people who didn't make it into the vaults who survived.
Mm-hmm.
And just started doing human stuff, like, again, immediately afterward. Vault Vault 8, right, which is Vault City. I think that's Vault 8. Mm-hmm. It opened 20 years afterward.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Vault City's been like kicking around for a long time. And so it's not, you know, the opening intro to Fallout 2 and both and Fallout 1 would suggest that there was a large gap of time between the bombs falling and then the world kind of starting up again. But the timeline itself, right, this kind of like really rigid, here's month by month what happened, it steps in to kind of order this world and say like, well, no, there would be people who knew it was LA. There would be people who knew it was San Francisco. And, you know, like it's not like language goes away. People can still read signs and things like that. So no, right? Like there's this, you know, what in science fiction studies, right? What you call like cognitive empiricism. There, mm-hmm. you have to put your brain into the context of the system in front of you. And if you can logically progress it forward in an empirical way, in the same way you would the real world, then it's science fiction, right? This is kind of a Darko Suvin thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is something you and I have talked about, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. But I think what's really happening here is a fight between some fans who want Fallout to be a kind of a sci-fi fantasy and some people who want it to be a sci-fi game. And I think Chris Avellone, by taking the timeline in particular and really making sure that it works and is coherent, is taking a sledgehammer to the fantasy style game, mm-hmm. and is making this a science fiction game.
Yes, absolutely, right? Like that is, this was like one of the first things I said to you when I was reading the Fallout Bible, is like, I was like, oh wow, the debate at this time was not whether or not Fallout is satire. The debate that is happening is what is the genre of Fallout, right? Yeah. Like in broad strokes, because like, you know, satire is a generic mode, but like just sort of like full stop, what is the genre of this setting? Is the question. And the choice is not between, like, you know, satire and whatever we want to say is opposed to satire, like, you know, empty whatever. Whatever is going on in contemporary Fallout, whatever you want to decry there. The choice is not between those, right? The choice is between these two different inflections of science fiction. Is this science fiction that has a kind of materialist logic to it, or is this more of a wacky science fantasy story? And yeah. It would be, I think, disingenuous to try to map that onto the satire question and debate. But I will say one of the things that I think it resonates across time here is this contemporary question of, like, and I say it's a question, but I don't actually think it's a question, because the people who tend to put forth this argument are not people that I agree with or like very much. But like, gaming is escapism, right? To what degree should like the real world, quote unquote, be evident in the games that I'm playing, and the problems and concerns of people in the real world? How much should they influence my gaming experience? And very obviously what I'm getting at here is that the people who entertain these questions and usually answer no are people who don't face the problems that are facing a multitude of people who like to see their experiences in games just as much as, you know, some guy who wants, I guess, like a, frankly, right, like a murder simulator. Like, I'm going to go blow things up in the wasteland, and I don't really want to think about the setting or why these things are happening and sort of the lore context of anything. Is a game fundamentally like a power fantasy for the player, sort of irrespective of anything else? Or is a game sort of the creation of a sort of setting or narrative or situation that in some way is meant to provoke discussion, interpretation, and things like that?
Yeah, and what's interesting about that too, I think, is that you can see places where this is getting navigated in the Fallout Bible here, and in the way that he answers questions. But those are things that I think are still never really addressed in Fallout. So, for example, there's a question that comes in about, like, does racism still exist?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the person who is asking about racism, I don't know their thoughts, I don't know their inner feelings, but the way that the question is phrased makes it seem like they really want racism to exist in the thing,
mm-hmm.
which is, Which is interesting. I don't know why you would ask a question being like, I hope racism exists. But what's actually fascinating about the answer is that Avalon answers, well, yeah, this is a world that is just in the future of our world. Of course, racism would still be around. And yet, what's not addressed there in any way, and what the question I have immediately is like, well, where? Right.
Right.
Like, where is it if it is obviously in there? And so there's an interesting thing going on where like the empirical answer is yes, if this is a science fiction thing where we are progressing from some principles that are shared with our world, then racism would exist. But then there's this kind of fantasy element of magicking away structural racism in the future or in this fictional universe and then seeing what happens in a number of different ways.
Right, like the racism that you see in game is transposed almost entirely onto ghouls and super mutants and things like that.
Yeah, right. And so there's like this system of, I mean, it's that's closer to fantasy than anything else, right? It's the orcs and versus mm-hmm. humans problem, right?
Right.
The way that our real world race issues get allegoricized onto, fictional species, other species. There are other places too where I think it's really interesting. There's a question on 138 where Rhombus on the David, aka Rhombus on the Boards. Shout out to Rhombus on the Boards if you're listening, I guess, from 2002. But this is the whole answer. It's this question of the 1950s you were talking about. You know, what's the timeline split? What's going on? He says, hey, the explanation I've heard as to why there's no nuclear winter in the Fallout world is this. In the 50s, they didn't know about it. And since Fallout is retro 50s, it's based on what they thought were the effects of nuclear war. The scorched earth with lots of mutated critters. So it's like kind of what you're talking about. But what's interesting here is like everything that Avalon is saying about the game flies in the face of something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's not just like a 1950s ideology exploded, into a full world. That's antithetical for how Avalon is putting this world together in some way. And that's antithetical to like what the Bethesda games do. So like whatever contestation was happening at the time here is completely obliterated. Avalon's like way of thinking through this logical, empirical science fiction, that is what we have now in Fallout. So what is interesting to me is that like whatever the debates are about what the classic games did versus what the games are doing now, whatever those debates are in whatever kind of form, the thing that is not debatable is that the past of Fallout is quote unquote solved. Like we know the genre, mm-hmm. we know what it's doing, we know what it's about, and we know what has to carry on from there. And that is fascinating to me
mm-hmm.
Because it's so unapparent at the time.
Yes. No, so. It is. And we learn like you put one of these on the Range Touch Twitter, right? But we learn about these things that got cut from the game. One of them being from the first game, the Slanter, which is a faction of mutated hyper intelligent raccoons.
Yeah,
that you were planned to meet in the first Fallout game. You would have encountered them basically between the LA Boneyard and the eastern part of the world map where you start out. And we get some concept art of these guys, right? And they're like little anthropomorphic raccoons holding spears. And we get a whole rundown of what the quest chains for this area would have been and how the society of the Slanter works. And it's very, very fantasy, right? It's very the comparison that I drew was with the Gamma World setting, which obviously mm-hmm. Fallout borrows from to a large extent. But Gamma World is much more explicit about being a science fantasy setting where like a huge technological disaster has happened. And I think in the first run of the game, it was a nuclear war. And I think in the latest series, it's the Large Hadron Collider turned on or something. But anyway.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that the most recent versions did that.
Yeah. But like the basic premise of Gamma World is that, some sort of technological disaster happens and like all technological knowledge and scientific validity flies out the window. And it becomes like a science fantasy world. So we get a huge chunk of what could have been in the first game that had it been there, had it really been there, I think it would have been a lot harder maybe for Avalon to pull everything in quite this generic direction when he starts with the Fallout Bible, because it's not something that has to be reconciled, even though it is something that ends up kind of becoming one of the bits of interesting color that is provided through the Fallout Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. You can read the whole, in the Fallout Bible, there's the entire design document of, like, what the quests were supposed to be, all that kind of stuff. And I think it's really interesting to read. Other stuff that's in here that's a little bit weird. What did you think of the, like, the apocalypse that happens? I mean, did you read through the timeline, like, beat by beat of what occurred there?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the thing that really struck me about reading through the timeline is that if you look at the Fallout timeline as it exists here, it is a very dour story about several world powers just riding slipshod into fascism, essentially. Yeah, so the timeline that Avalon puts together and what... a couple things struck me about it. One is that it's an extremely dour narrative because it's about, you know, sort of these world powers riding slipshod into fascism, essentially. Like straight up the resource wars, as they're called in the backstory, is about the United States and China, both of them needing resources, and in order to get resources as fuel deposits, like fossil fuel deposits and things like that are running out, this is one of the reasons why everything kind of swings back toward nuclear power in the Fallout setting, or like that's one of the reasons given for it. So this is happening, but also like the United States and China just set about like invading and annexing other countries. And there's like discussion of like protests and riots and like protesters being like massacred in the streets, and sort of given the situation of the world at present, like the thing that strikes me about this timeline is that we never have any idea who is protesting these things. This is a history that is written entirely from the government's perspective, essentially, right? The government's perspective is taken as kind of like the view from nowhere that is necessary to tell world history. And so, sure, right, there are resistance movements and protest movements in the United States, but we don't know who they are, what their stories are, and what they're doing, and they don't seem to show up in any significant way post-apocalypse. Mm-hmm. So... you know, that's one thing that strikes me, right? That it's something about sort of the imagination behind the project gets illuminated there when you just kind of accept that for the precondition for this story that I want to tell is everyone became fascists and then they all murdered each other.
Yeah, and so it becomes very easy, I think, to say something like war never changes, right?
Yeah.
From a naturalized perspective of states doing violence to one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been interesting, you know, we've been tweeting the past few days about kind of our long form argument in this series and how that maybe runs up against the way that people talk about the Fallout games and, you know, specifically got a tweet about, you know, about talking about the war never changes things, that people are going to do violence to one another no matter what. But there's a question of like, what kind of violence are people doing and what is the mode of justification for that? That is never talked about here and never addressed. And there's like no factions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice in the timeline that President Richardson was helped by his father, President Richardson?
Yes. Yes, I did see that.
So there's a little bit of that. Like, it doesn't really matter because the man's going to get us,
mm-hmm.
Kind of logic to it. I also thought what was interesting about the kind of the apocalyptic statements there, too, is that it's a very 1990s apocalypse. It's not, and I think this might have to do with, like, why we don't know what the people are protesting, is because it's not about the clash of ideologies. It's very end of history kind of stuff,
yes.
Right? So, like, the end of the world comes about not because there are people with differing views about the way the world should go, or about different modes of justice, or about different ways of thinking about how the state should deal with its people or with one another, but because there's just not enough to go around, right? Mm-hmm. So it's oil shocks, resource wars. There's a socially transmitted new plague.
Yeah.
Interesting. And that's actually why FEV gets developed, which I didn't realize, mm-hmm. is that it's meant to be like an aerosol vaccine that turns into an evolutionary virus.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not, there are no competing ideologies in the world. Everyone accepts that like the world is just how it is. But there's not enough to keep everyone kind of doing their thing. And so that's why the world ends.
Right.
But it's interesting, too, in there we get... So that still seems to be the logic in the Bethesda games. You know, just kind of thinking about going forward, right? That explanation, as far as I can remember from playing, you know, Fallout 3 and 4 and New Vegas, mm-hmm. and some of 76, that's still the kind of core logic of the history of the world in the Fallout universe. We get quite a bit of information here about the war in Alaska with power armor and all of that. Mm-hmm. That's a key part of... the Fallout universe still. We get to play that in one of the DLCs for Fallout 3, or we get to play a
simulation
like
of it.
A simulation, yeah, like a VR thing of it. So, you know, I'm belaboring, I think, the timeline a little bit, but I think it's important to note how much of what we take to be just the truth of Fallout at this point over the past four games or so, that is set in stone in a forum document that really is just trying to like post hoc cobble together some sense of coherence between Fallout 1 and Fallout 2.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that one person wrote Sulik and Hakunin?
I did not know that until I read this document. Wrote Sulik, Hakunin, and the Elder.
Yeah, so every character in the game that's got a weird kind of pseudo racist thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of some pseudo racist things, I just want to point this out. Did you note the part where it is considered a twist, quote unquote, that Lynette in Vault City is totally okay with slavery because she is a black woman?
Yep, that's twist. It's going against something. Mm-hmm. Going against what you would expect, I guess. Yeah, yeah, I did see that. It gets called a twist. Also, I think in that question, they ask why Lynette has like... Oh, no, it's not in that question. It's in a different question, sorry. But there's a question that comes up that is, why is Lynette so mean to you? And in the question, basically asks if Lynette is, quote unquote, a jet baby.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, 100% like a crack baby reference. Mm-hmm. It is like a deeply... It's a deeply racist question to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way that it is formulated is just, like, fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just... And here's, I think, a key part of this, right? Avalon will answer any question that comes up. And so, like, that is not edited out of the thing. That's not ignored. Like, that is taken on its own terms as a question one might ask. And then is answered in a, you know, in a coherent way,
mm-hmm.
to do it. And so like there's a way too that the Fallout Bible is very accommodating to literally anyone's views of the world, and anyone's way of asking a question, that is, it's just, it, you know, it's from a different time on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a community manager fielding that question in the year 2020.
No, absolutely not. What do you think of all the here's a question for you. What do you think of all the references to fanfic?
Quit sending it to me because
yeah.
I can't read it. Evelyn says that repeatedly. There's a lot of that, and there's a lot of people clearly asking questions about, hey, if I wrote this in my fanfic scenario, would that be coherent with your world?
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, it actually seems like a lot of the fan theory generation is them trying to cobble something together to create a platform for their own fic or for their own scenario writing. I think, and I remember this from being on kind of Fallout-y forums, you know, in the early 2000s too, there were a lot of people who were writing like RPG scenarios around Fallout,
mm-hmm.
basically. And people like talking about the different ways that they were doing that and ways that they were, or people making quote unquote sequels to Fallout or like fan games that, you know, I never saw a single one of.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was the kind of FIC community, as broadly construed as you can, I think constituted a lot of the labor here of people. That was their investment for trying to figure out why all of this was working together, was to, in order to make their own stories. Which maybe, you know, has something to do too. I think FIC writing people and people who are investing in creating their own fan content, I think those are a big reason for like story Bibles coming out now. So for example, you know, Magic the Gathering releases or has been releasing over the past few years. Every time a new world comes out, they release kind of these like world, not quite storybooks, but like content Bibles, basically. So it's like, here are all the factions. Here's what they look like. Here's the style guide. Here's all the information about it. And, you know, other than appreciating art, I think the primary reason for giving people that is if they want to, say, run their own RPG campaigns around it,
right,
or something like that. It's enabled to give people, or it's intended to give people a stable platform from which to build other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that sort of brings up the other point to make here is that one of the things that we are, like, all the stuff that we've been talking about, sort of the clockworkification of the setting, or what we might also call, like, the wikification of the setting. Goes Fallout, thus has gone popular culture, because this is what everyone's all about now, is creating the setting and the lore and sort of the cruft, right? The environmental cruft in which you can stage a narrative, and people will love the narrative, sure, and they'll love the characters, but if there's not an expanded universe beyond it, then what are you even doing?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's a big investment. You know, Bethesda's all about this, right?
Yes.
This is the Elder Scrolls. This is Fallout. I mean, I think they understand that half of the investment in the products that they make is an investment in the world in a general sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting when that it's going to be fascinating, I think, to revisit Fallout 2 or Fallout 3 and Fallout New Vegas with these ideas in mind and kind of the things that we focused on or the things that the first two Fallout games have brought up for us, because I just don't know. I can't think off the top of my head about their relationship to this kind of consistency and this broadness of lore. So, for example, like on, I think it's on page 56, there is a kind of beat by beat explanation of how the Vault Dweller and his ragtag band of rebels or whatever, you know, whoever he has with him, they go to Arroyo and they found Arroyo and then they like do that. And it's what we talked about all the way back in the first episode of Fallout 2, where we're talking about this kind of primitivism thing, right? Mm-hmm. This logic that if you remove people from society and you plop them in a space, then we like go back to the Stone Age, or we go into quote unquote like tribal, society. And then we got to build from there. And it's this progress narrative. We talked about it back in that thing. But on page 56, Avalon goes through a beat by beat of like why and how that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating, and later in the document, someone sends in like examples of that happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this beautiful kind of moment of demonstrating ideology, because what it's treated as if like they have, you know, regressed backward in time.
Right. Like it's treated as this is a scientific principle. When these sorts of things happen to people, here's what they do.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%. As opposed to this is just a different mode of organizing society and organizing labor. And it's different from one that we would do if we lived in apartment blocks.
Right.
Right.
Well,
like,
I mean,
like these things are not organized hierarchically. They are organized spatially. They are equivalent, but they are different modes of being.
Right. Well, it's like the essential argument is that if you were to take me, Michael, right now and drop me in, I don't know, the most remote part of Wyoming and told me to like live and survive and you know, make my own little encampment or whatever, I would do the exact same thing that a like Christian missionary whose boat crashed in the Amazon in the 19th century did. What they did is they like integrated into the tribes that happened to already live there. And so like I would just, I guess, create my own tribe, right? That's the kind of logic that is being operated on here.
That's a great way of putting it, right? Because there is already a social formation that in the Amazon that the missionary can fit into.
Right.
Right? Like it's not as if it jumped up from nothing and like you know, a blank slate appeared, right? This mode of social organization, it is material. It already exists. It's someone fitting into that. And it's amazing to me that, you know, Robinson Crusoe, right, which is the kind of bootstrap liberalism logic, you know, out of nothing, one will make do. That's a whole book about a dude like trying to recreate his day-to-day technology.
Yeah, right. It's right. Like, yeah, that's the point of Robinson Crusoe. Or one of the points, I guess, of Robinson Crusoe is that he ends up on this deserted island and he does everything in his power to recreate what it is like to be a you know, an English middle class person in the 1700s.
Yeah, he's like, I want a hot bath. Mm-hmm. That's my number one thing, right? And there are obviously like a lot of things wrong with Robinson Crusoe, right? But it's interesting that like the heart of what we would think of like self-madeness ideology, right? That this like skips all of that mm-hmm. kind of stuff and goes to like this weird, almost like bio-truth style, like trans-historical thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not trying to belabor that, and we've talked about it on the show a few times already, but it is interesting that that is being actively talked about and debated and fit into this kind of Clockwork Universe in the same way that, like, the minute that the bombs dropped is fit into that Clockwork Universe. Everything is equally explainable when it enters into the Fallout universe.
Mm-hmm.
The NCR Rangers that we see later, those are kind of pre-created here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he's talking about Tycho mm-hmm. and the kind of wasteland connection with that character. But if you read all of that stuff, that just gets recycled again and kind of put into the NCR Rangers
mm-hmm.
Later on. There are a lot of dev jokes and references. There is no reference to Canadian literary poetry though.
No, none at all.
So no one picked that up 20 years ago.
Oh gosh, what is there's another big scenario that's not the slanter. It's at the Department of
The EPA.
Yes, Environmental Protection Agency. This is another big scenario that we get that was cut out of Fallout 2, and I just want to mention that because of everything in Fallout 2, could have been in Fallout 2, of everything in the Bible, the EPA mission sounds like Fallout 3.
Yeah,
like I read that. So if of course, again, if you have not read the Bible, the basic idea is that in Fallout 2, at some point while wandering the wasteland, you would have come across an abandoned building that had once housed the Environmental Protection Agency. And it would have been staffed by a series of like artificially intelligent holograms, like computer systems, who are still going about kind of their day to day in all of these, you know, weird fractured ways as they have slowly, you know, not been maintained since the war. And so they're facing all of these problems. Some of them have glitches. Some of them talk in ways that you don't understand and so on and so forth. And the idea is, you go through this building and you sort of learn, like, what were people researching here? What were they doing? What was happening? And you, you know, either fight with or in some cases fix the holograms and so on and so forth. It feels like Fallout 3, right? That feels like what happens in Fallout 3 is that you're going through the wasteland. You find a thing that used to be a place, right? And not just like, these are all, like, this is a... These places used to be houses and now they're ruins, or like this place used to be some sort of public building and now it's a casino. No, like you go to a sort of piece of civic or like social infrastructure and you comb through it and you find out a little bit of a story of the people that were working there or living there up until the moment that, you know, everything went to shit. And in the process, you're also interacting with all of these relics of the bygone world, sort of the weirdness of the technology and so on and so forth. It just feels straight up like you could pull that EPA thing out of this book and drop it into a Bethesda Fallout game and it fits perfectly.
Yeah, I think there is so much more connection between the world that was and the world that, you know, the post-bombs world. in those games. And it's interesting that got cut out of this one.
Mm-hmm.
Same with, there's a straight up Canticle for Leibowitz faction that was just cut out of the game too. And
my heart was forever broken, right? Like our first Brotherhood of Steel episode, I was like, I have always wanted a Fallout game that really, like, you know, went for it with Canticle for Leibowitz. And it turns out they almost did in two.
Yeah, and they just decided not to. But so it's interesting that, like, those things fell out. And we don't really have a reason for why those things fell out. I'm assuming it's just because of development time.
Right, like scope.
Other thing here, there are interesting moments where you can, like, see additional parts of what I have now begun to term in my head Fallout ideology coming out. you know, it's like these ideas about what the basic assumptions of Fallout, how those map onto reality in some way. Mm-hmm. So, for example, so on page 29, this is a quote from Avalon. Horrigan's low intelligence, which was further damaged by the FEV exposure, made these conditioning programs take root easily. And these are conditioning programs to, like, control his behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a direct linkage here between intelligence as a statistic and, like, gullibility.
Mm-hmm.
Like intelligence is an absolute value of, like, mastery of the world around you. And if you don't have it, I mean, basically you're inhuman in the Fallout universe if you're not intelligent. Like, and I'm laughing because that is so absurd. And that is, like, 100% what's going on. And it really informs, you know, you can go listen to Mages and Murder Dads. We talk a bit about intelligence in Planescape Torment, but that whole idea of, like, intelligence and wisdom in particular giving you the ability to better ascertain the world around you is that, that's the ideology of that game too. So there is a through line there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if you can figure out who that through line is. but so like, that's part of Fallout ideology, right? They're like, intelligence is just supreme.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that quite a bit before. The other one too is on page 79, where there's a question about if raiders have culture.
Yeah.
Which is just like, there's this idea that, like, the bombs dropped and, like, literally all human memory is wiped away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one can think. And like, everything is gone. And so this is another instance where Avalon, like, has to step in and be like, well, you know, empirically, if that were true. But that's the difference between fantasy and science fiction too, right? I mean, in a fantasy story, you could just kind of hand wave away and say, like, everyone forgot the traditions of the old world, and now we're in the new world. And raiders don't have culture, and they don't have marriage, and they bootstrapped it up from nothing because they worship, I don't know,
snakes.
You know, snakes, or yes, snakes, or a potato that grows in the ground, or whatever. And so, but you know, there's an activity of wrangling here. This is science fiction because
mm-hmm.
there's a logical material connection into the past that we can kind of trace and follow, and it makes sense, and it all flows from this pseudo 1950s forward. So it's interesting stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to explain my snakes crack, one of the ways mm-hmm. that Avalon, like, intervenes in this question also is he talks about all of the cultures for the various raider factions that were cut from the first game. So they had, like, highly developed raider factions that all had kind of, like, there was a raider faction that worshipped snakes, right? That was their mm-hmm. thing. And eventually, in the progress of developing that game, they whittled them down just to one group, the Khans. So there is a lot of, again, interesting work being done here where, like, Avalon will, when it is convenient, say, well, that's actually not true because of some content that we cut. Mm-hmm. Some stuff that's not in the game, but that I am sort of, like, fixing into the broader universe of the game as part of this larger continuity building exercise.
Well, what's your final estimation of the Fallout Bible, Michael?
It sure was a series of blog posts. It's an interesting document for a couple of reasons, but I am not going to say, like, oh, everyone needs to read the Fallout Bible now. It's interesting, really, you know, for me as, like, someone who's been playing these games and as kind of a academic slash sort of historian, history-oriented person, right? Looking at how this franchise is getting imagined and built here.
Yeah, I think reading it sharpens the show a little bit because it gives us some ideas about linkages between things. I don't think, weirdly enough, because all of this is like post hoc, you know, creating things and kind of stitching them together, I don't think it really allows me to understand Fallout 1 and 2 better, but I do think it allows me to understand everything that happens afterward. And also, I think the fan reactions to those things.
Yes.
The idea that there was someone kind of managing, that there was a direct connection, what you were saying at the beginning of the episode, a direct connection to the development team that is managing expectations. And then you see all of this, like, it's clear the developers are really thinking about this and doing it and blah, blah, blah. And then these people don't even work on the next game. And then the next game doesn't have anything to do with these things. And so I can imagine if you were a huge Fallout 2 fan who'd been on the forums and you're waiting for Fallout 3 to come out and all that, you see it and you're like, but what could have been, right? And by that point, too, there's a lot more information about Van Buren that was out. So I think there was even more ways of feeling burned. We'll talk a bit about Van Buren in our first Fallout 3 episode when we do that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think I would recommend, you know, anyone sit down and read this 200-page document, especially because the last 70 pages or so, I would say the last three updates or four updates, it becomes increasingly more about commentary about the commentary that happened in previous Fallout Bible updates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not people asking questions about the games anymore. It's people asking questions about responses to questions that were in previous updates. And it's like, it both becomes unreadable and becomes like not, the stakes are very low for that, right? And so I wouldn't say that this is necessary in any way. Michael, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Warren Is Dead.
Got anything you want to plug?
I do not.
I got something I want to plug.
Oh, what do you want to plug?
It's a little podcast called Just King Things.
My goodness.
It'll be coming out sometime after you hear this. Probably, you know, you got to keep an eye on twitter.com/rangetouch. You got to keep an eye on youtube.com/rangetouch. You got to keep an eye on patreon.com/rangetouch. Links for all those things are down in the description below this. The reason I say that is, did you know that there's a Stephen King reference in this very document?
I might have caught it, but I didn't mark it. What is this Stephen King reference?
On page 95.
Uh-huh.
It says the lobstrosities
from
the drawing of the three could theoretically be in the oceans in the Fallout universe.
Very good.
Could it be that Fallout 1 and 2 were long-lost sequels to Stephen King novels? Who could know? I will simply say that if you want to hear Michael and I read Stephen King novels and then talk about them in publication order, every single one of them, it's going to take us the next 9 years. We could have a huge falling out. We could hate each other by that point. We could really be a McCartney and Lennon at that point.
Yeah.
Or perhaps a Waters and the other guy no one likes from Pink Floyd.
Bataille and Lyris.
It could be that. Well, we'd become friends again at the end if that were the case. Who else we got? Famous rivalries down through history. Snape and Harry Potter's dad.
Yes. Snape and Harry Potter's dad. The thing is, they were never friends.
Oh, okay. I haven't read any Harry Potter novels.
Yeah.
or I haven't read any in a very long time.
Harry Potter's dad was, like, quite literally Snape's, like, high school bully.
Well, and I pull off my mask.
Michael. It turns out you've been my high school bully this entire time.
That's the kind of thing you can look forward to in the Stephen King novel. but yeah, so we're going to be doing Just King Things. It's a podcast. It's supported by the Patreon. We set a donation or a patron amount per month, and we smashed through that number. Thanks to everyone for doing that. But we're going to be talking about Stephen King novels in the same way that we talk about the Fallout games. We're going to read one an episode. It's probably going to be monthly. It literally is going to take like the better part of a decade to do them all. Assuming that he, writes at the same pace he is writing right now. So if you're excited about that, keep an eye on rangetouch.com, and you can also come join our Discord to chat about it if you want to. I'm probably going to throw up a little chat thread for that, chat room. I don't know what those are called.
Channel?
In Discord. A channel, there you go, in our Discord thing. That's a long post-amble, but we will be back. So basically what's going to happen here is that you're going to hear this episode in probably 1 month from today, whenever you're listening to this when it came out, will be when we start Fallout 3. We always need a little bit of a break between games so we can kind of get ahead in case, you know, I don't know, an accident happens or something like that. So we need a little bit of
that. In
case
there's a pandemic or something, you know.
Yeah, you never know. You know, I could develop psychokinetic powers and be unable to play for a few days. So I could begin writing a novel and having a slow breakdown in my hotel that I'm taking care of.
Mm-hmm.
A vampire could show up. There could be a haunted laundromat.
Yeah, my very large cat could get rabies.
There could be a finger in the toilet. If you're curious about all these ideas, just King things. Okay, anyway, we'll be back in a month from now with a new episode of Too Much Future, and we'll be starting with Fallout 3. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you then. Everything changed.